Dear Hank and John.
Or as I prefer to think of it, Dear John and Hank.
It's a podcast where two brothers answer your questions, give you dubious advice, and bring you all the week's news from both Mars and AFC Wimbledon. John, do you know how the Romans would cut their pizzas?
How?
With Little Caesars.
I'm
happy pizza, Miss John.
I'm very vulnerable right now to bad jokes. I'm taking my laughs where I can get them. It's been a little bit of a challenging week here at the Green household, and that is also a top-notch joke.
Yeah, so I'm glad to have some pizza jokes for you.
It is indeed Pizzamas in our community, which means that it's a two-week period where Hank and I make videos back and forth to each other on our YouTube channel, Vlogbrothers, every day, just like it was 2007 again. And we raise money for charity by selling a variety of different items featuring my face with a mustache. In fact, Hank, as I am making this podcast, I don't know if you can hear it, but I still have my annual Pizzamas mustache. I don't know if it's affecting my intonation at all, but it's there.
I remember the conversation with you when you were like, oh God, Pizzamas is coming up. I have to decide if I'm going to do the mustache.
Yeah.
And then I seem to like have put it in my mind that you weren't going to do it, and that's why you didn't have, weren't like growing out a beard, which you have to do in order to get the mustache. But then, like, suddenly, it was there. It just arrived.
Yeah. Well, at this point, I don't want to brag, but I've reached a level of maturity where I know how many weeks of beard I need to have a really horrifying mustache.
Yeah.
So if you go too long, the mustache actually looks pretty good. And if you don't go long enough, the mustache doesn't look like much at all.
Right.
But if you're going to get to that worst possible mustache that I'm relying on for Pizzamas,
right,
I know exactly how many days of beard I need. And I don't want to brag, but I think I crushed it this year. You can go to youtube.com/vlogbrothers to see for yourself. But I think
you got the perfect.
I think I hit it out of the park.
Yeah. What I've never seen, John, and what I want to see is you with the like the full year mustache, like the kind of mustache where like the mustache hairs on the top have to like sit on the mustache hairs on the bottom. So there's like an inch of like, it's just going out before it gets to the end of the mustache.
Yeah.
That's what I want to see on your face. And I don't think that it's ever going to happen.
No.
Because like, you don't get one of those mustaches without a lot of commitment.
Yeah. Well, also it would be really bad for my marriage.
And also eating food, be hard, bad for that.
And potentially for my relationship with my children. Last night I was reading Alice a book and I said, on a scale of 1 to 10, Alice, what do you think of the mustache? And she said, I guess a 3. And then she paused and said, well, really a 2, but I don't want to hurt your feelings.
Yeah. Well, John, I'm excited for Pizzamas. We are in the midst of it now. And this is the last episode of Dear Hank and John that will remind you that you can go get stuff at pizzamas.com. But which is our new Pizzamas website. And if you wait until next Monday when the next episode comes out, pizzamas.com will be closed. It'll be over. This is a 2-week experience, and then it ends.
And you can never, ever get any of the amazing 2020 Pizzamas stuff ever again in your entire life, including the ridiculous and terrifying Pizzamas 2020 mask.
God. All right, John. Here is a question from Molly, who asks, Dear Hank and John, why does fire have such a specific shape? When you make a fire, it almost looks like a leaf or as if it's climbing. Why is it like that? I'm staring at a fire right now and I can't stop thinking about it. Please help. Like the country, Mali. What? Like what? Is there a country called Mali?
Yeah, the one in West Africa. It's spelled differently.
Oh, I see. Yes, there is.
Yeah.
John, looking at a fire is one of my favorite things, and it is remarkable for how long you can do it.
Yeah, so one of my all-time favorite books, Parable of the Sower by Octavia Butler, has in it a drug that causes you to want to do nothing other than to stare into the flames of fire, which does seem really just realistic to me, because every time I stare into a fire, I think, I do not get tired of doing this ever, which is weird, because I get tired of every other form of staring in the natural world. And secondly, I think this is like the oldest form of human entertainment.
Just looking into the fire. Yeah.
Yeah, we've been doing this for so long that like, I think it's deep. I think it's deep down that I like looking at flames.
Mm-hmm. It does make me wonder if, like, if I did it every day, would I eventually be like, ugh, another fire? But I don't know, maybe not. It's really cool. That's always different. It looks very interesting.
Yeah, it's always changing. But why does it appear to sort of lick up into the sky or to have that sort of leaf structure? Is there a chemical reason?
It's a physical reason. So it's basically a reverse teardrop. So like the fire is going up, and as it goes up, the convection currents like sort of push the heat into a narrower band.
Mm.
And of course, this is because fire is made of gas, not liquid. It's much less uniform than if it were than like a teardrop is, or a raindrop in that like very specific raindrop shape. But it's basically that, but like much more dynamic because it's a gas and convection currents are very stochastic, very random. So, which is why fire never looks the same ever. You look at it once, you'll never see it look that way again, which is great. But there's lots of air moving around, and there's the certain air that is very hot, wants to get up. So you're seeing the air currents that are created by the heat of fire.
That's really cool. That now it's going to be even more fun for me to look into a fire. All right, this next question comes from Elise, who writes, "Dear John and Hank, obviously none of us are going out to Halloween parties this year. Right, everybody?
Right, everybody?"
Nice work there, Elise. "But I work at a library which will be open on that spookiest of holidays, and it's typical for staff working to dress up. I need to be wearing a mask while in my costume, obviously, but I feel like just a rubber Party City mask is probably not going to do the job."
No.
"Now, dressing up as a doctor or a nurse could be in poor taste, or maybe not. I don't really know. It's just sort of bleak, though. What's a fun creative costume I can incorporate a mask into so that I'm not just a cartoon character who happens to also be wearing a mask? I'm kind of low on ideas, and I need something fun. When you rent an apartment, you sign... Elise."
Nice. Well, so first of all, I think that it's fine to be like, I'm going to be Ted Theodore Logan of Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, but during the pandemic, and so Ted is wearing a mask.
Exactly.
Like, Ted would wear a mask.
Yeah.
Because Ted wants people to be awesome to each other. So
I'm dressed up as the dude in Big Lebowski, and just as the dude would in 2020, I'm wearing a mask.
So I think that that's fine. I think that there will be lots of Halloween costumes that incorporate masks intentionally, and lots that are just like, look, I am Bart Simpson, but masked.
Yeah, or you could go with another hyper-contemporary costume, Elise, like Tiffany, who's saying, "I think we're alone now."
But masked.
That's a joke. That's a joke just for Hank. Nobody who listens to this podcast remembers that song except for Hank.
I love that song.
It was that was the first vinyl record I bought with my own money, was Tiffany's album. I desperately wish I still had it. Like, how come I held on to all this stuff from childhood, but not Tiffany's classic "I Think We're Alone Now" cover?
Oh, God. Who else? I mean, so there are some, like, plenty of heroes who wear masks.
Yeah.
You could have all the people from the Watchmen television show wore masks.
Mm-hmm.
There's that going on. And also you can wear things that have masks, but then wear a mask under the mask, and then no one will see the mask because you'll be like, you know, Richard Nixon or whatever. Like those terrible rubbery masks that people put on over their heads.
That reminds me that a friend of mine has a kid who told them, "I want to dress up like one of those bird people." And the friend was like, what do you mean? like where you have a big crow head. And the friend was like, "You want to dress up like a plague doctor?" And the kid was like, "Is that what they're called?"
Yeah, plague doctor works.
Yowzers.
Yeah.
Yeah, so go, you know what? That's it. We did it, Elise. Go as a plague doctor. It's not appropriate for nine-year-olds, but you're going to crush it out there as a plague doctor.
Oh, my God. I think there's going to be a lot of plague doctors this year, John.
I mean, as long as they're celebrating in a safe and socially distanced way.
Oh, Lord.
That's great.
The other thing I'll say, Elise, is that I've just gone to a website where there are a bunch of masks that you can buy that are super weird and festive and could incorporate easily into Halloween costumes. There's sequined masks, and there's studded masks, there's Burberry masks and Jack Skellington masks. And so you can build your costume around your mask.
That's great.
Or just wear a mask and be like, "That's my costume. I didn't want to work hard." All right, Johnny, here's another question. This one's from Caroline, who asks, Dear Hank and John, why do dumpsters all smell the same, even though they all have different stuff in them? Some dumpsters can smell worse than others, but all generally smell the same to me. Is there some explanation? Pumpkins and penguins, Caroline.
I never knew that until it was pointed out to me, but it's so true.
There is
from
a dumpster
my
smell.
Garbage can to like the largest dumpster I've ever been near, they all have the same smell.
They have a, there is a smell that is dumpster, which is interesting.
Yeah.
I would not say that all dumpsters smell the same, having been a person who spent a fair amount of time around them.
Hank used to rescue electronics and textbooks and repurpose them and sell them on eBay. It was part of the business that we here at Dear Hank and John know best for the part of the business where he stole all of my baseball cards and sold them on eBay.
So I did not find those in a dumpster.
Nope.
But yeah,
found them inside of packaged, laminated, because they were all in mint condition, including the entire starting lineup of the 1986 Chicago Cubs.
John,
what were we talking about?
You really got me started on my business career, and I appreciate it. That's the kind of assistance that big brothers do and that little brothers appreciate for their whole lives. So thank you.
You're welcome.
There, see?
You're welcome.
All right. So there are certainly dumpsters that don't smell bad at all. Like office building dumpsters don't tend to have much of a smell. And then like a sushi place's dumpster is going to smell terrible. And I actually found a Reddit thread from a garbage person who talks about all the different smells of different kinds of dumpsters and that, you know, restaurant dumpsters tend to have stronger smells than, you know, your average dumpster. But I think there is something to the dumpster smell. And here's what I think the dumpster smell is. I think the dumpster smell is a lot of food that's a little bit old. So like that smell.
Mm-hmm.
And add on to that a little bit of food that's very old.
Right.
Which is just the stuff that's like stuck to the bottom.
It's the cake, the stuff that's caked.
Yeah, it doesn't
come
out. To
the various walls.
Yeah.
Right.
When it gets dumped.
So I think it's mostly that smell, actually,
because
for reasons we don't need to get into the exact details of, I once had about a third of a Big Mac underneath my bed for about 9 months. And it smelled similarly. It smelled like a dumpster, but in a smaller package.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Speaking of which, if at all possible, someone could have a talk with the worms that crawl into my office to die, that would be great.
Oh.
Because they don't smell good.
Yeah, I have that same issue, actually, in my basement. It's like the worms think to themselves, well, it's time to go. And I know how I want to do it. I want to do it in a way that slightly inconveniences John.
Yeah, like every once in a while I come into my office and I'm like, it kind of smells in here. I wonder, like, I guess I'm just a funky dude. And then I clean, because, you know, it smells all clean. And then I'm like, no, it was all the goddamn worms in the corners.
I look forward to all the emails that we're going to get about how the fact that we have worms in our basements are symptomatic of some horrible disaster. Anyway, this next question comes from Kavita, who writes, Dear John and Hank, I'm a sophomore in college and I've been 18 for less than a year. First off, Kavita, no bragging.
Are you bragging just because it's just being young bragging to you now?
Yeah. Yeah, don't brag about being 18, okay?
Don't come to me with your age.
Yeah. You've already hurt my feelings, Kavita, and we're not even a full sentence into your question. Not since my daughter said that my mustache was a 2 have I felt so called out. I've been 18 for less than a year, and I've been excitedly and not so patiently waiting till the day when I can vote, and I very much plan to do so when I get my mail-in ballot. Yet still, on every social media platform I use, they keep telling me to vote. I understand that it is important to reach the young people and whatnot, but it's getting quite annoying. How can I make it known that I am going to vote? So that the FBI agent who is watching over me and presumably personalizing my ads for me sends other ads my way. A newbie nerd fighter, Kavita.
Oh boy. This is, so just as an example, I recently bought a Chevy Volt, John. I went ahead and did it.
Congratulations.
I got a 2015 Chevy Volt. It hasn't arrived yet, but it's on its way.
It's a good year.
And yeah, no recalls on that one. And
yeah, it's good vintage.
I am still getting ads for Chevy Volts. And I'm like, look, like, I know these aren't cheap ads because car is a big purchase. And so these are expensive advertisements. And like, if you are so all-knowing, internet, notice when I buy something and stop, because yeah, I'm not getting another Chevy Volt.
This reminds me of my all-time favorite tweet from April 6th, 2018. Some would argue the peak of Twitter. Written by someone named Jack Rayner. Dear Amazon, I bought a toilet seat because I needed one. Necessity, not desire. I do not collect toilet seats. I am not a toilet seat addict. No matter how temptingly you email me, I'm not going to think. Oh, go on then. Just one more toilet seat. I'll treat myself. The ads are so good. You know, they're so perfect, except when it comes to knowing that, yeah, like, me buying one toilet seat is actually sure evidence that I am no longer in the market.
Yeah. Yes.
And I'm not going to be in the market, hopefully, for many years.
But Kavita, we have no idea. We have no idea if you're going to vote or not just by your social media profile. And that's good.
Right.
This is good. We want to live in a world where the government and the social media companies don't know whether or not we're going to vote.
Boy, do we.
But yeah, so you are experiencing us trying to reach, or us, people trying to reach people like you. And there are other people like you who are not made up their mind about whether they're going to vote, or they don't have a voting plan. And so we have to, and so they're going to continue to try to reach them.
I know it's annoying. It will end. It will end in less than a month. But in the meantime, maybe if you can take the opportunity to try to make sure that people who maybe aren't seeing those ads or aren't affected by them also have an opportunity to vote. This next question comes from Yvette, who writes, "Dear John and Hank, I'm a high school government teacher." Yvette, thank you. While we're talking about voting, high school government teachers are incredibly important to the future of our country, or another country if you live in a different country. Yvette, I don't know why I presumed you were American, but anyway, thank you. Occasionally, my students will ask me a question that both makes me marvel at their curiosity and also makes me question everything around me. The other day, a student asked me if humans will one day run out of dirt. I, of course, had no idea how to answer this question and told them that I would get back to them ASAP. Soil and Soylent, Yvette.
Oh, well,
I mean, in some ways, yes.
Yeah.
And in other ways, no. It depends on what you define as dirt.
Right. So here is the situation. Topsoil is renewable. It is a thing that is created by the biosphere and geosphere of Earth. So it is something that, you know, is constantly being replenished, and there is more and more of it. However, at the same time, various agricultural techniques decrease the amount of topsoil. That topsoil will run off. And right now we are kind of using it in quotation marks. It's not like it gets like sucked up into the plains and we eat it or anything. It's just like through the process of agriculture, there is less and less topsoil when you do certain kinds of agriculture. We are using it faster than it is replenishing itself. It takes a long, it's surprising. Dirt is actually very complicated. It takes a long time for dirt, especially what we consider to be topsoil, to be created and kind of create itself, because it needs, like, dirt is more, it's easier to create dirt when you already have some dirt, stuff like that. And so this is a concern. The UN's Food and Agriculture Organization has warned that, like, we could run out of topsoil in the next 60 years. That affects how water works. It affects carbon dioxide absorption. It, of course, affects how much food we can make.
Great.
So to give you another thing to worry about.
I didn't have that on my bingo card, but I'll be sure to put it on there.
But there are a number of ways to have topsoil reduction happen less. And I think that, you know, I think in the latter half of my life, which I'm entering, that we will see a lot of new ways to make food that will be a lot more sustainable and might even open up some land that was once agricultural to being natural again.
I disagree with the notion that you are now entering the second half of your life.
What, because I entered it a little while ago?
Well, because you don't know. It seems very presumptuous.
It's true.
I mean, it's possible you entered the second half of your life like 6 or 7 years ago.
It's true, John. Thanks for bringing it up.
But it's also possible that you're not going to enter the second half of your life for another like 13 years.
Yeah, but like, it's not possible that I'm going to enter the second half of my life in like 30 years.
I mean, it is possible. It's just
very unlikely.
Let's be honest. My point is only that you don't know where you are in the timeline.
I don't.
Like, we don't know where we are in the timeline of our species.
Oh, God.
You don't know where you are in the timeline of your own life.
Your country.
We don't know.
Yeah.
We need to... Oh, boy. He went there. First he sells...
I mean, you went plenty of places first.
You know what I was thinking about recently, Hank? And I don't want to take it to too dark of a place, but I was thinking recently that the last tweet... the last Facebook post and the last email will almost certainly not be sent by a person.
Oh, it's probably true, huh?
Anyway, we got another question. This one's from Lydia, who writes, "Dear John and Hank,
oh God,
who had the idea for keys?
Oh,
I was thinking about keys and how cool they actually are and how like before them you couldn't lock your dwelling. Mm-hmm. I assume doors came before keys. So how did people protect their homes? Key in to know the answer, Lydia."
Well, John, they had the... When do you think? Can you give me like a rough like century or even millennia when you think keys happened?
So I know that like 1,000 years ago, if you lived in a French village,
yeah,
like one way that people would check in on you would just be to like lift up your roof. And they'd just like lift up your roof and they'd be like, how's it going? And you'd be like, oh, pretty good. You know, it's
hey, Jean-Paul.
Just another full moon here in 9th century France. So I'm going to guess that keys were invented. But on the other hand, like castles maybe had keys. I'm going to guess that keys were invented in the year 622 CE.
4000 BC.
Oh, I was... really close. I was on the right track.
Yeah, the oldest key lock we know of is from Mesopotamia, so modern day Iraq. It was a pin lock. It had the key itself was wooden, but the pins were brass. And to make the key, you had an artisan that would carve the key. Now, it's wild to me that like locks happened in concert with civilization, with like the first food storage, the first like concentration, like, you know, see, like real like leaps in concentration of power that happened in Mesopotamia. And and before that, your lock was just a armed guard. But they made a lock.
Wow.
And it worked. And it is extant, like it still exists.
I've always said extant, but I think that either way is probably acceptable, which reminds me, actually, that today's podcast is brought to you by keys. Keys. There's one from 6,000 years ago that is extant or extant.
This podcast is also brought to you by fire. Fire. Look at me.
We're only having podcast sponsors today from the broadest possible. Today's podcast is also brought to you by targeted toilet seat ads. Targeted toilet seat ads. No, really, once I've bought one, I have the one that I need.
And also, this podcast is brought to you by Vote.
Vote. Please vote. If we can get one email from one person who voted as a result of us asking them to vote,
oh my God,
I will be so grateful.
Yes. Every email we get from somebody who's like, yes, that's like, that will fill my heart so much. That's like a day of life that we need right now.
Yeah.
Like you will be the thing that makes our day better that day.
Yeah. So if you don't have a plan to vote, make a plan to vote, if only to make Hank happy.
We'll be so happy. Make my day.
We also have a Project for Awesome message to read. It's from Jared from Ohio to Dwayne, Christina, Jason, Kat, Adam, and Aaron. All three of my older brothers are getting married this year, so I guess they warrant a shout out. Congratulations, bros, to each of you and your wonderful brides-to-be on finding love and companionship. May you only grow closer as the years go by. Through thick and thin, may this new chapter of your lives be the best one yet. Also, hi, Mom and Dad.
Wow.
Hi, Jared's mom and dad.
That's wild.
That is wild.
Three brother marriages. I hope that's all gone as expected. I'm sure no hitches were in anybody's giddy up.
I hope it's gone as well as can be expected and safely.
Yes, exactly. John, this next question comes from Aileen, who asks, Dear Hank and John, we commonly use water to make pasta,
yeah,
presumably because it's widely available.
Correct.
And non-toxic.
But is that's not the only reason.
But is there another substance we could safely cook spaghetti in? The stress is on the A and the E is silent. Aileen.
Yes.
I can only think of two edible liquids that aren't water.
Well, there's a lot of edible liquids that aren't water. And you could make pasta with Gatorade.
Well,
you could.
Gatorade is water.
Okay. I mean, it's not water, as right, anyone who's ever drank both water and Gatorade can tell you.
Okay, like, I would.
I'm not a scientist, but I'm pretty sure that Gatorade is not water. Like, when I turn on the tap at my home, orange Gatorade has yet to come out.
So I'm approaching this as a chemist.
What you're saying is that...
The liquid part of Gatorade is the water.
I agree with that in the broadest strokes, yes.
Yes, whereas there are two liquids that I could come up with, broadly, that are not made out of water.
Milk?
Milk is also made out of water.
Okay, what do you got?
There's oil, which is also in milk. So like liquid fats.
Uh-huh.
And then there's ethanol, which is, you know, pure grain alcohol, Everclear is what we're talking about.
And that burns off pretty fast if you're trying to boil pasta with it.
So I think that it won't be possible to boil pasta. Did I say possible? It will not be possible to boil pasta in oil and get pasta, just because I think that because oil is nonpolar, I don't think that the pasta would like dissolve in the same way.
No, I feel like if you do that, you get deep fried pasta. That's how you get fried pasta.
Oh, dang. Deep fried pasta invented today. It's the potato chip of tomorrow.
I did not invent it.
Oh, shit.
I'm sure that it's been done a lot of state fairs around this great country.
You're probably correct. But I am more interested in the ethanol question of whether I can have just like extraordinarily intoxicating noodles.
Oh, God. Oh, that'd be so gross.
And you are right that it would boil off really fast. Ethanol is a really low boiling point. So you'd have to do it.
You would need a gigantic vat.
No, I think you need a pressure cooker in order to get the ethanol hot enough to actually cook it.
Okay.
You have to increase the pressure so that the boiling point goes, the boiling temperature increases.
Okay.
And so you need like a pressurized vat. The problem here is that do not do this with a pressure cooker in your home, because that pressure cooker is designed for water.
Don't do any of this. Alcohol is super flammable.
It is very flammable.
Everything about this idea is so bad.
Like, yes, but
there's no part of exploring this that should be done by anyone who does not have a PhD, not just in chemistry, but in this kind of chemistry.
Exactly. So I would like that person to make me booze noodles.
No, I don't even want to put that person at risk. Listen, if you
know the SOPs for how to get ethanol to a high temperature and pressure safely, put pasta in it for me.
Hank's given up on the whole thing about how he'll be really happy if you just vote. Now he'll only be happy if you find a way to boil noodles in pure grain alcohol.
But no, seriously, do not do this in a home pressure cooker, because I'm pretty sure that it would create an explosion. So just for clarity, this isn't not like wouldn't it be fun if we tried this? No, it wouldn't. But I do want a booze noodle.
Okay, before we get to the all-important news from Mars and AFC Wimbledon, I want to answer this question from Daniel, who writes, Dear John and Hank, I spend multiple hours a day listening to podcasts to help me cope with my anxiety, and recently I've noticed a theme of people cutting for an ad break, but no ads showing up. I assume this has something to do with the pandemic and the recession, but does this mean my favorite shows are at risk of disappearing altogether? Pre-order the Anthropocene Reviewed book now. Daniel. Thank you, Daniel. That's a great, I really like your sign-off.
Well, first, you do not have to be worried about this podcast, which is extraordinarily inexpensive to make. Also, the money that it makes, almost all of it, through Patreon and through advertising goes to Complexly to help make stuff like Crash Course and SciShow and Eons and all those shows. So the way that this works is like a lot of podcasts have switched over to dynamic ad insertions, which is how like YouTube ads work. And instead of like baking the advertisement into the podcast, which is this is the case on our podcast, we just sort of like stop and then we record advertisements at different times, and based on who you are, based on where you are, or just based on whether we have an ad to sell that week, like oftentimes we just don't have, like our inventory is not 100% full, then a piece of software will insert an ad into the episode. And it seems to me that since that's kind of taken over, I've had more experiences of just not getting an ad. And what that says to me is not so much that like this podcast doesn't have any ads, it's that like they didn't have an ad for me right at this moment. And right. that's probably okay. I think that the podcast advertising ecosystem, if you're worried about that, is mostly all right now. There was a pullback in the beginning, but there's a lot of businesses that are sort of like trying to figure out how to adapt to a new moment, and they have to communicate about how they might be changing. Or, you know, businesses that are well suited to this moment, they want to communicate about their services. So our experience is that the podcast business is not hurting too much right now, certainly compared to a lot of other businesses.
That said, Hank and I are considering buying out all the inventory on our own podcasts. That's not a joke.
I don't know if we're gonna make it happen, but I do see why you would want it to happen. It's an interesting idea.
It's not just that I want it to happen. Like, I feel like people who listen to our podcasts want ads that are targeted to them very specifically, in the sense that they are about our work.
Indeed.
We hope to be able to do that at some point, but obviously, like, that's a lot of revenue that's coming in that's supporting other educational projects at Complexly. So we've got to do it carefully. But I really like the idea of only selling ad space on this podcast to me.
We'll see what happens. John, is it time for the all-important news from Mars and AFC Wimbledon?
It is. Would you like to go first this week?
I'd be happy to do that. Many people thought this was going to be last week's Mars news, but it came in just a little bit too late. So Mars, as you may have heard, John, 2 years ago, scientists reported that they had found a large saltwater lake under ice and Mars's south pole. But we weren't sure exactly what it was, so researchers went back, gathered more data from the European Space Agency's Mars Express, which has like ground-penetrating radar that bounces off the surface, but also off of stuff beneath the surface of Mars. And by studying how those waves bounce back, we can learn what's underneath the surface of Mars, which is amazing. We use that on Earth all the time for lots of different reasons. Find subsurface glacier lakes is one way. Like, we could find water that way on Earth. We can also use it for like mineral exploration kind of stuff. But from this, researchers were able to not only back up the 2018 discovery, but they found three more lakes. The lakes cover about 75,000 square kilometers, the largest one around 70 kilometers across. So there is a lot of discussion going on right now about what these lakes are. Are they actually lakes? Like, there's still a little bit of debate about like what other things could represent this kind of finding, but it seems very much like this is water, like liquid water. There's also, how are they liquid? Because this is, it's cold. So either it may be some combination of warmth from geothermal activity. Like, maybe there was like some kind of volcanic activity that happened down there, warmed some stuff up like a million years ago or something, and it still hasn't refrozen. Because there's also all of these different salts in the water that raise the freezing temperature, that lower down the freezing temperature, so that even if it is very cold, it is hard for it to freeze.
Right.
So it is not a good place to find water that astronauts would use, because actually the frozen water on the surface is more pure than this water that would be, you know, and it's easier to melt water than to purify it.
Mm-hmm.
But it might be a good place to look if you're going to find any signs of prehistoric life or even current
life. They could still have life going on down there.
That's right. I mean, it would have to be very resilient to live at those temperatures and at those salinities, especially because this isn't like sodium chloride table salt, which is also hostile to life, but this is like even more hostile to life salts.
Still, those are some big lakes.
They are big lakes.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
If you think about the way that we understood Mars, I know. Or at least the way I understood Mars when I was a child, and the way we understand it now, it's just mind-blowing. It gives me so much hope about the future.
Yeah.
Speaking of hope about the future, Hank, AFC Wimbledon suffered their first loss of the League One season to Accrington Stanley, a team that we are better than but keep losing to. They've always been a team that we struggled against. No matter how good we are and no matter how bad they are, they always find a way. And I felt like, especially in the first 30 minutes of the game, we were playing so well. We scored a goal. Ryan Longman scored his second or third goal of the season. It was a beauty. And then we just, at the very end of the first half, we gave up two goals in quick succession, and we were never able to play well in the second half, never able to get back into the game. Accrington Stanley killed time really effectively, and we lost. So it's frustrating to go from 1-0 up to 2-1 down. That said, there are still, I think, promising signs about this year's Wimbledon team. Like, we look like we are playing as a team more. We look more effective in attack than we did last season. Like, last season, whenever we would score a goal, I would think to myself, well, that was borderline miraculous. Mm-hmm. Or like, thank goodness for that random deflection. And now I see actual plays, you know, like mm-hmm. players running into space, passes meeting the players where they are. I see hope, for lack of a better term. Wimbledon are now in 12th place in League One after four games. Obviously, it's still the beginning of the season. We've got 42 games to go if we end up playing all the way through the season, which, fingers crossed. But 5 points after four games and in 12th place, I will take that all year long, especially if the table freezes right where it is right now, because Wimbledon would finish in 12th and the franchise currently plying its trade in Milton Keynes would finish in dead last.
Oh, Lord, John. It's a wild, wild story you've got us all invested in.
It's crazy that they still exist even, let alone that they're in the same league. Anyway, thank you for potting with me, Hank, and thanks to everybody for your questions. You can email us at hankandjohn@gmail.com.
We're off to go record our Patreon-only podcasts this week in Stuff, where we talk about something that is making us feel good right now, and that's available at patreon.com/dearhankandjohn. This podcast is edited by Joseph Tunametish, produced by Rosianna Hals-Rojas and Sheridan Gibson. Our communications coordinator is Julia Bloom. Our editorial assistant is Dabuki Chakravarti. The music you're hearing now and at the beginning of the podcast is by the great Gunnarola. And as they say in our hometown,
don't forget to be awesome.